أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Welcome to this episode of Let's Recite the Quran. My name is Brother Muhammad, and with me in the studio we have Brother Masoom, Brother Hassan and Hussein, and we're missing Ali. Wherever you are, Brother Ali, we miss you a lot in the studio, in this episode at least. Alright, so we will continue the recitation of Surah Al-Ma'arij, Surah number 70, chapter number 70 of the Noble Quran. We had finished up until verse number 12. Inshallah, from this episode onwards, we will do verse number 13 and onwards, inshallah. I'll ask Brother Masoom to kindly recite verses 13 and 14 and maybe even 15 for us. Brother Masoom?
Yes, sir. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وفصيلته التي تؤويه ومن في الأرض جميعا ثم ينجيه كلا إنها لظى.
Ahsantum, a very beautiful recitation. Now, there are certain points that I want to focus in this episode, and the first one is actually tafkhim. And we will focus on tafkhim and tarqiq more in this episode because there are quite a few examples in the verses that we're going to recite. And the first example is actually in the verse number 13 that you recited, Brother Masoom. Can you point out the word, the letter that that has tafkhim? It's at the beginning of the verse.
Saad.
Saad. Tafkhim basically means to recite it with a heavy voice.
Yeah.
Usually, tafkhim, one of the best ways of recognizing tafkhim is having a rounded mouth, a heavy voice, and reciting it as if you're reciting a heavy word. وَفَصِيلَتِهِ الَّتِي. Now, if you did not do tafkhim, it would have been like وَفَصِيلَتِهِ الَّتِي. Somewhat more like a seen than a sad.
Yes.
Right? And so therefore, فَصِيلَتِهِ الَّتِي تُؤْوِيه. And keep in mind, in تُؤْوِيه, as in many instances that some of our brothers and sisters make mistake, Hamza has a cutting voice. It's not تُؤْوِيه, تُؤْوِيه, right? In many cases, people do not recognize the Hamza here. Hamza, although it is sakin, it gives a cutting voice. Even if it is mutaharrik, there's always a cutting voice. You need to distinguish between the makhraj, the execution of Hamza, and the other letters as well. وَفَصِيلَتِهِ الَّتِي تُؤْوِيهِ. Right? Can you tell me what's going on between in the second verse, in verse number 14? Why did we recite وَمَن فِي الْأَرْضِ and not وَمَن فِي الْأَرْضِ?
It's because of إِخْفَى.
إِخْفَى. And the ruling of إِخْفَى says what?
It says that if after noon ساكن, mm-hmm. if there is a letter that is a throat letter.
A mouth letter.
Uh-huh. So then we can apply إِخْفَى.
Ikhfa. So basically, the ikhfa, as you rightfully mentioned, the criteria is that whenever we have noon, sakin, or tanween, after which we have a mouth letter. For example, in this case, it's fa. Fa comes from the basically you're using your tongue, not much of your tongue, maybe your lips, and it's a mouth letter basically to say. And it's a mouth letter, and so therefore, this we apply ikhfa. Ikhfa basically means you hide the sound of noon and you give it a ghunna. وَمَن فِي الْأَرْضِ. You do not say noon completely. وَمَن فِي الْأَرْضِ. Keep in mind, well, the brothers in the studio can look at me, but those who aren't, they can trust me that I am trying to prepare for the fa as I recite the noon. وَمَن فِي الْأَرْضِ. My lips are preparing myself for the recitation of fa. وَمَن فِي الْأَرْضِ جَمِيعًا ثُمَّ يُنْجِيهِ. Keep in mind, we have some more ikhfa in the same verse. جَمِيعًا ثُمَّ يُنْجِيهِ. It's the same ruling again. Ikhfa. ثُمَّ is one of the letters of mouth. And so therefore, since it follows the tanween, and tanween in actuality is Nun Sakin, there is ikhfa applied here, a ghunna, with the hiding of Nun sound. جَمِيعًا ثُمَّ يُنْجِيهِ. And يُنْجِيهِ again is ikhfa. Ja is one of the mouth letters. It is followed by a Nun, and so therefore, we silence the sound of noon and give it a ghunna. Ghunna again basically means a nasal sound and a little bit of a stretch. Yunji. And finally, kalla innaha lava. And you rightfully did a waqf by the kalla. What kind of a waqf was that?
It's salah, which is better to continue.
Exactly. So the alamatul waqf, the sign of waqf, the sign of stopping in the Quran is a salah, right? Salaya in this case, right? This basically means that it's better to continue, but you can stop. If you continue or stop, how do you do the med of this? Because kalla, there is a med on the alif at the end.
The med would be about four counts.
Okay, so whether you stop or continue, correct?
Yes.
This is called ja'iz munfasil. So you can go up to five or six. It's up to you, preferential. Or you can stop at four as well. Kalla. Right?
Sure.
But if you're continuing, is only when you can do ja'iz. You can go up to six or five or six. If you're stopping, you should stop at four. Kalla. But if you're continuing, kalla innaha lava. And keep in mind the va at the end, ba va at the end, la va, it's a tafkhim letter. You always have to recite it with a heavy voice, a rounded mouth. La va, right? If you did not do it with tafkhim, meaning if you do it with tarqiq, if you recite it lightly or flat, it will be like this. La va. Lava, as if you're smiling, right? You give it a smiling smiling mouth, so that the flatness is there. But over here, you're not allowed to do so. This is one of the tafkhim letters.
And his nearest kindred who shelter him. And whoever is on the earth entirely, so then it could save him. No, indeed it is the flame of hell.
I'll ask Brother Hassan to please recite verses number 16, 17, and 18 for us. They're quite short.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Nazza'atin lishawa. تدعو من أدبر وتولى وجمع فآبى.
Alright, so I'll give you a chance to take a look at the verses number 17 and 18 and tell me if I'm reciting it correctly. تدعو من أدبر وتولى.
No, you should hide the sound of the noon.
I'll recite it one more time, and I'll ask you one more time to see if I'm reciting it correctly or not. تَدْعُو مِنْ أَدْبَرَ وَتَوَلَّى.
I think you should read it تَدْعُو مِنْ أَدْبَرَ.
No, that's not the problem. You're at the correct position, but you're not referring to the correct problem. Exactly. So there's a fatha and kasra difference over here. You recited تَدْعُو مِنْ أَدْبَرَ وَتَوَلَّى. It was supposed to be تَدْعُو مَنْ أَدْبَرَ وَتَوَلَّى. And mind you, there is no إِخْفَى or إِدْغَام in this case for you to do غُنَّة. Alif is one of those letters that is not a mouth letter, and so therefore إِخْفَى is not applied, and it's not one of the يَرْمَنُون letters, so إِدْغَام is not applied. It's just basically إِظْهَار. تَدْعُو مَنْ أَدْبَرَ وَتَوَلَّى. And then the verse after that, tell me if I'm reciting it correctly. وَجَمَعَ فَآوَى. Did I recite it correctly?
No.
How was it supposed to be recited?
وَجَمَعَ فَآوَى. فَآوَى.
فَآوَى. Yes. Correct? أحسنتم. Very beautiful. Now just keep in mind that in verse number 17, we have two قَلْقَلَ. Can you point them out for us, Brother Hassan?
Yes.
Yeah.
Tad'u.
Tad'u. Which one of the letters of Tad'u is Qalqala?
Dal.
Dal. Very good. And the next one?
The in the letter adbara.
Very good. The dal in the word adbara, right? So when you're doing qalqala, basically for any of the letters qutub, jad, qaf, ta, ba, jim, and dal, any of these letters when they are with sukoon, we give it an echoing sound, right? Because they're very similar letters and they can be mistaken with one another when they're sakin. We give it an echoing sound, not a haraka, not a fatha or a kasra, but an echoing sound. تَدْعُوا مَنْ أَدْبَرَ وَتَوَلَّى Whereas if without قَلْقَلَى it would have been تَدْعُوا مَنْ أَدْبَرَ وَتَوَلَّى Correct? Very beautiful.
نَزَّاعَةً لِلشَّوَى
A remover of exteriors.
تَدْعُوا مَنْ أَدْبَرَ وَتَوَلَّى
It invites he who turned his back on truth and went away from obedience.
وَجَمَعَ فَأَوْعَى
And collected wealth and hoarded.
All right, so I'll ask Brother Hussein to finally recite for us verses number 19 and 20 for us, please.
إِنَّ الْإِنسَانَ خُلِقَ هَلُوعًا إِذَا مَسَّهُ الشَّرُّ جَزُوعًا
Ahsantum, very beautiful recitation. Keep in mind that إِنَّ, there is a ghunnah involved there. Why is there a ghunnah? Because of
tashdid.
Tashdid. Now that this tashdid really comes from idgham. Two of the noons together, they were separate, but then they became mudgham, they became merged, and so therefore we do idgham on that, right? Keep in mind, in what letters of the yarmanun letters do we do ghunnah?
Yarmalun letters.
Yarmalun. Which one of the letters? There are two letters we don't do ghunna in Yarmalun.
Yamun, Ya, Mim, Vau, and Nun.
Very good. Ya, Mim, Vau, and Nun we do ghunna on. Which ones we don't do ghunna on?
Lam and Ra.
Lam and Ra. Very good. Innal insana. There is one more ghunna involved over here. Tell me which one is this. Tell me where do we do ghunna and why. Innal insana.
The first noon of insan.
Very good. Because of?
Because after that there is a letter seen.
Seen.
So because of that we...
Seen is a mouth letter.
Yes.
And the ruling that is applied over here is ikhfa.
Yes.
Right? So whenever we have a noon sakin followed by one of the mouth letters, we have ikhfa. We just explained this in this episode as well. إِنَّ الْإِنسَانَ خُلِقَ هَلُوعًا Keep in mind, خَا and قَا is a tafkhim letter, rounded mouth and a heavy voice. إِذَا مَسَّهُ الشَّرُّ جَزُوعًا شَرُّ Again, over here is a tafkhim letter.
إِنَّ الْإِنسَانَ خُلِقَ هَلُوعًا
Indeed, mankind was created anxious.
إِذَا مَسَّهُ الشَّرُّ جَزُوعًا
When evil touches him, impatient.
Alright, so let's recite all of these verses together. I'll ask the brothers to repeat after me. أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ بِسْمِ اللَّهِ الرَّحْمَنِ الرَّحِيمِ وَفَصِيلَتِهِ الَّتِي تُؤْوِيهِ
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وفصيلته التي تؤويه
ومن في الأرض جميعا ثم ينجيه
وَمَن فِي الْأَرْضِ جَمِيعًا ثُمَّ يُنْجِيهِ
كَلَّا إِنَّهَا لَظَى
كَلَّا إِنَّهَا لَظَى
نَزَّاعَةً لِلشَّوَى
نَزَّاعَةً لِلشَّوَى
تَدْعُو مَنْ أَدْبَرَ وَتَوَلَّى
تَدْعُو مَنْ أَدْبَرَ وَتَوَلَّى
وَجَمَعَ فَأَوْعَى
وَجَمَعَ فَأَوْعَى
إِنَّ الْإِنسَانَ خُلِقَ هَلُوعًا
إِنَّ الْإِنسَانَ خُلِقَ هَلُوعًا
إِذَا مَسَّهُ الشَّرُّ جَزُوعًا
إِذَا مَسَّهُ الشَّرُّ جَزُوعًا
صَدَقَ اللَّهُ الْعَلِيُّ الْعَظِيمُ
صدق الله العلي العظيم.
And that was the beautiful recitation of Surah Al-Ma'arij, verses number 6, verses number 13 to verse number 20. And we will end this episode of Let's Recite the Quran, inshallah, with the salawat on Muhammad and his pure progeny.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Let's recite the Quran, a joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International Schools. ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we provide an in-depth analysis of Israel's criminal behaviour and the effort it puts into influencing international policymakers and global public opinion. In today's show, we'll be examining who's behind the crisis at the BBC and how this relates to the corporation's coverage of Palestine and Israel. In our first report, Latif Abu Chakra explains the role played by BBC board member Robbie Gibb in fomenting the upheaval in Britain's supposedly public service broadcaster.
An Israel lobby coup has taken place at the BBC with the resignation of Director General Tim Davey and new CEO Deborah Turness. But why have the Scottish First Minister, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, Ed Davey, and the union representing the largest number of BBC workers, BECTU, responding to this news by calling for BBC board member Robbie Gibb to resign? Gibb was the key mover behind this coup and is working for foreign interests. He was part of a consortium which saved the Israel lobby rag, the Jewish Chronicle, alongside former chairman of the Charity Commission, William Shawcross, John Woodcock, former head of the Labour Friends of Israel, and Jonathan Sakadotti, former head of the Zionist Federation. Gibb was a co-founder of the rancid channel GB News, which has worked against the BBC from its very inception. Gibb also has a paid job for the Kext CNC PR company, founded by Israeli Gershon Kext, a chairman of the Weizmann Institute in Israel. Kext CNC is a subsidiary of Publicis Group, and according to an internal message from Global Chief Executive Officer Arthur Sadon, many staff have already been called up to the Israeli military for the genocide in Gaza. All of Gibb's media outlets outside of the BBC have been calling for Davey to resign for supposed pro-Palestinian bias for several years. Israel's Deputy Foreign Minister, Sharon Haxel, even publicly called for Tim Davies' resignation in June 2025. The primary catalyst for the resignations was a leaked internal dossier from Michael Prescott, a supposedly independent advisor to the BBC's editorial guidelines committee. This memo, leaked to the right-wing Daily Telegraph, specifically accused the BBC Arabic service of anti-Israel and pro-Hamas biases and minimizing Israeli suffering in its Gaza coverage. This report was set into motion by Gibb, who appointed Prescott to carry it out. Simultaneous to that, Prescott is employed by PR firm Hanover Communications, which works directly for Larry Ellison's Oracle firm. Ellison is so close to Netanyahu that he offered him directorship of Oracle and also is the highest individual donor to the Israeli military in history. The Board of Deputies has long expressed concerns about the BBC's anti-Israel bias and called for deep cultural change after the resignations, seeing them as the start of a renewal process. This was an Israel lobby coup.
As usual, I'm joined in the studio by David Miller, who's the UK's foremost scholarly critic of Israel and our resident expert. He's a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. Our guest contributor today is the author, broadcaster, investigative journalist, and former BBC insider, Tony Gosling. Welcome to the show. David, what do you know about this Robbie Gibb character and his role at the BBC?
Well, Robbie Gibb is the chief Zionist enforcer at the BBC. He's on the five-person editorial executive committee, which oversees all news and current affairs decisions. But he's not the only Zionist enforcer. There are many more, including on the executive committee. There are two or three others on the executive committee who are Zionists. And then further down the chain of command, there are many more in the newsroom, etc. But Gibb is a very interesting character. This is a guy who, of course, was involved with the Jewish Chronicle. The movement of the Jewish Chronicle from being an extremist Zionist organization to being an ultra-extremist Zionist organization. And of course, involved with, as the film showed there, with GB News. One of the interesting things about him, which is not widely known, is that he used to be a Western intelligence agent in the Soviet Union. Him and his brother, both of them. His brother, of course, has been in a kibbutz in Israel. It's said that they're not Jewish, but they were the CIA, it looks like, in the Soviet Union, involved with an organization which also had previously had MI6 involvement, but MI6 had pulled out of that. So this is a guy who's got intelligence links and, of course, now has been central to the takeover of the Jewish Chronicle, in fact, in charge of that takeover.
Wow. Well, Tony, I mean, the BBC has a history, doesn't it, of MI5 vetting its employees, but what's happened here differ from that?
Well, look, I think we have to understand what the BBC is and what broadcasting is, how it fits in to the rest of the world, because it's a relatively new thing to be able to broadcast live people speaking in the last 100 years, really. And so really what broadcasting is nowadays is a new thing, which is like the nervous system of humanity. So people can in real time supposedly see what's going on in other parts of the world. And whether it works or not is in the 1920s set the BBC up. We're aware that it could be used as a weapon of war. And that's why when they first started it, they came up with this slogan, nations shall speak peace unto nation, which was underneath the badge, you know, the sort of public BBC. And of course, it has actually, in my lifetime, I think, been co-opted. But MI5, you're quite right, that's Britain's internal security service, were exposed in the 1980s by Mark Hollingsworth as vetting all the staff. I managed to get in by other routes. Basically, I knew some people who were news producers in London and got in that way. But if you were to try and go through many of their official procedures, someone like me is unlikely to have managed to get into the BBC. MI5 most definitely involved in that. And I think we're now in the situation where that has become absolutely embedded in the corporation. You've got, not just the BBC, in other private broadcasters and newspapers in the capital. So, for example, home affairs correspondents will all be basically public relations people for MI5. Attached to the home. the Foreign Affairs stable of journalists all pretty much saying the same kind of thing, associated with an MI6 point of view. In terms of finance, we've got the UK budget this week. You'll find all of the London correspondents looking at finance are being told what to think by the City of London and vetted by the City of London. So what we've got does not reflect society whatsoever anymore. It just reflects these sorts of elite institutions, as you mentioned, like MI5.
Yes, indeed. And in terms of the Zionist impact, though, Attorney, just say a word about that. I mean, obviously, talk about the MI5, I mean, and you've sort of set that out very, very clearly, but does this differ from what's gone before? I mean, what's going on now?
Well, okay, so I started at the BBC in the late 1980s as a researcher and then went on to do reporting and journalism. I was there at a very interesting time because, Victor Rothschild, who was part of the Rothschild family, a very influential Labour peer, spoke to Marmaduke Hussey, who writes about it in his autobiography, who was the chairman at the BBC at the time. And he said to Marmaduke Hussey, can I see the director? So that was what was going on in the Thatcher era, because Alastair Milne was the director general of the BBC, who's basically like the chief editor there. And he was doing programmes which were critical of the Thatcher government. They had a panorama which was exposing the far right within the Conservative Party. I found it interesting that it was actually Victor Rothschild that broached the subject of getting rid of that director general. And then they replaced him with Michael Checkland, who was an accountant, and then with John Burt, who was the director general when I was working there.
To David, though, now, if I may, Tony, because we haven't got too much time. And I just wanted to get your thoughts, David, about, I mean, Latifah, as we heard, referred to this guy, Michael Prescott, in her report. I mean, just say a bit more about his role.
Well, this is yet another of the very many issues corruption within these processes. So Prescott had a dual role. He was working for the BBC and also for this PR firm, which of course has got all sorts of other clients, including of course working for the big tech firms, including Oracle, run by Larry Ellison, the guy who's just taken over TikTok and CBS, yes, and is looking to take over other media platforms in the US, international media platforms, and of course, if they can, they want to take over as many media platforms as they can, and so that's what's behind this coup at the BBC, is an attempt to make sure that nobody in the mainstream media or in social media is able to be critical of the genocide.
Right. Okay. Well, Tony, I mean, why do you think Israel and its lobby groups then are so fixated on the BBC?
Well, of course, it's because they want to create the impression that what the Israelis are doing is correct and right. Back in the 1990s, we had Zionists appearing in our newsroom. They come from outside broadcasting. It was questionable whether they were actually competent broadcasters, but they were pro-Israel. And there were lots of people raising eyebrows around our production office, Marylebone High Street, at Greater London Radio at the time, to see these people popping out of nowhere. So the process, I think, began in the late 1980s, early 1990s, including these kind of basically Zionist agents. Yeah. The idea really, I think, is to manipulate the public opinion. In fact, on a couple of occasions, I've had producers say to me, well, we haven't told the public what to think yet. And so there's an enormous amount of power in this whole broadcasting idea. But remember, they're speaking to less and less people. If you look at the Press Gazette's annual returns, you'll find that now it's a steady two-thirds, 65-70% of people in Britain don't trust what they see in the mass media anymore.
No,
so they've lost about two-thirds of the people.
I think that probably explains one of the reasons why the Zionist entity has lost the battle for public opinion, Tony. And I guess, obviously, the BBC still likes to trade on its sort of reputation, as it were, as being a trustworthy source. And maybe that's another reason why the Zionist entity is so fixated on it. But David, I mean, the Middle East BBC's Middle East editor of their news website, Rafi Berg. I mean, just say a bit about him, William, and his role in all this as well.
Well, I mean, Berg is clearly a very important element of this, but he's not the only one. I mean, there are Zionists spread throughout the corporation, and these are effectively Zionist gatekeepers. But Rafi Berg has become the most well-known because there's been stories about him, and of course there's this recent libel action which he is taking against Owen Jones, which I think is almost guaranteed to fail. But Berg is a fan of Netanyahu. He's written about the daring do of the Mossad, and he still remains in there as a kind of gatekeeper, along with many other Zionist gatekeepers inside the BBC, like there is in almost all of the other mainstream media outlets.
I'm trying to just get your thoughts, really, on this libel action that David just mentioned that Rafi Berg's taken against the Guardian columnist Owen Jones. What's your thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, people like Rafi Berg are literally embedded now within, it's almost like in the brain cells of humanity. They're making sure that they're acting like, David said, as gatekeepers. This is their job. Anyone who gets through, it stops anyone getting through. I remember hearing from Craig Murray, who I know is a friend of yours, how several times there are taxis taking him to a television centre to appear on a live television programme, and then the taxi driver has to turn around and take him back because somebody like Rafi, although he's an internet guy actually, has intervened. Yeah. I mean, that seems to me to be the whole role nowadays of many of these specific individuals, and they don't reflect the humanity. I am very concerned, though, about this attack on the BBC at the moment, because we've got a privately owned it all the time, and the BBC is really the only counter to it from the public sector. And what we've seen over the years is cross-media ownership and a handful of media proprietors. We've just got the Daily Telegraph being taken over by Daily Mail and General Trust at the moment. It's falling into fewer and fewer hands, and it's not just broadcasters or radio or newspapers. It's also magazines and books, all forms of media. Yeah. In fact,
Tony, we're going to have to just move to our next report now, which looks at the fallout following the BBC's coverage of the Glastonbury Music Festival earlier this year.
Under international law, the right of people under colonial or foreign domination and foreign occupation to resist by all available means, including armed struggle, has been widely recognized and affirmed by numerous United Nations General Assembly resolutions. International law explicitly sanctions the targeting of occupying soldiers through armed operations. As occupied people, the Palestinians have the right to resist the Israeli occupation through armed resistance. However, punk rap duo Bob Villain has faced significant backlash and professional consequences, including canceled shows and revoked visas. Following pro-Palestinian comments made during their Glastonbury Festival set in June 2025. During their performance, lead singer Bobby Villain led the crowd in chants of Free, Free Palestine and Death, Death to the IDF. This reflects the view of numerous UN resolutions that Palestinians have the right to protect themselves against occupying soldiers through armed force. This incident at Glastonbury was used as a weapon to force Davy out of the BBC. Performance was live-streamed by the BBC, which later expressed regret for not cutting the feed, and it triggered a police investigation. Following a rabid Israeli lobby campaign, the band was dropped from several festivals and tours, including Radar Festival in Manchester, a show in France, and a German tour. In October 2025, they postponed two headline UK gigs in Manchester and Leeds, citing political pressure from figures like Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson and Zionist groups who called for the gigs to be cancelled. The U.S. State Department also revoked the duo's visa, forcing the cancellation of their North American tour. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Christopher Landau stated that
foreigners who glorify violence and hatred are not welcome visitors to our country.
Their booking agent, United Talent Agency, UTA, also ended its relationship with the duo. Bob Villain's lead singer has stated he is not regretful of the chance and would do it again. In a statement, the band clarified that they're not calling for the death of Jews, Arabs, or any other race or group of people, but rather for the dismantling of a violent military machine, and that they are being targeted for speaking up. The rancid push to punish the group has been led by UK Lawyers for Israel and featured other less well-known lobby groups also. This call from the stage at Glastonbury featured heavily in the campaign against the BBC and was successfully used to force the resignation of Tim Davie despite his capitulation after the fact. The UK Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer even joined in condemning the comments as appalling hate speech, adding to the pressure on venues. Despite the campaign, both Palestinian Resistance and Bob Villain still stand. The BBC, however, is a contested space.
Well, David, I mean, is what Bob Villain said actually controversial, in your opinion?
Well, it's become a very, very popular worldwide slogan. You hear it in demonstrations all over the world.
Yeah.
And, of course, it was something which was unusual in the British public sphere, not so much in America at the time, but in the British public sphere at the time. But it's become, they said when they did it, well, let's not have any more vanilla slogans, let's have something serious. And that, and he was making a serious point about the need to dismantle the so-called Israel Defense Forces. And, of course, that's what most young people now believe is necessary as a matter of simple policy.
Yeah.
So not controversial in that sense, but, of course, very controversial in the parallel universe of Zionist sense-making. And that, of course, causes them to clutch their pearls and lose all their combobulation and, of course, to try and stop him and the duo from playing anywhere, including, in Manchester, and a whole panoply of Zionist organisations got together for that.
They used to silence opposition. But, Tony, when it comes to Israel, I mean, why does the BBC and the UK's corporate media seem to be so opposed to the application of international law?
Well, the fact is, I don't think they really are. It's just the people at the very top. If you look at the BBC's executive and its board, the foreign countries such as Israel take a great deal of interest in who is on those parts of the organisation and what their views are. And they're constantly trying to manoeuvre their people into those positions. But I think there would be many people in the BBC who would be cheering, privately maybe, without their bosses seeing, about Bobby Villain's comments in the summer. And isn't it interesting how that came out through the music and entertainment arm? Because the current affairs arm and the news arm of the BBC is so totally controlled. What we should be seeing is people like Glenn Deason, Jeffrey Sachs, Colonel Douglas McGregor, Scott Ritter on the news every evening. Very good experts. But they're being gatekept by people like Bobby Villain. And the other thing to mention is it's great to see live performances, live television, live radio, etc. is far cheaper to produce than pre-recorded. But they like to pre-record everything nowadays, even though it's much more expensive, because then they can control it.
They can control
things
it.
They don't want to see.
No, indeed. Let me just move on to you, David. I mean, what do you know about this United Talent Agency then that dropped Bob Villain after the Glastonbury Festival?
Well, this is one of a number of talent agencies based in the US, and in common with much of the entertainment industry, there's an iron grip of Zionist executives at the top of it. One of its first attempts to make sure that no one would mention Palestine was when it dropped Susan Sarandon in late 2023, and of course they've dropped Bob Villain now. This is part of the way in which Zionists are able to control entertainment firms, Hollywood movie companies, the music industry itself. Zionists at the top of all of these companies, and this is something which we, of course, have remarked on this show before, but it's something which people don't understand very well, that actually the Zionists are able to actually run these companies and are massively overrepresented at the top of them.
Yes, indeed, and when we point that out, and people point that out, they sort of accuse us of indulging in anti-Semitism. It's
of course they do.
An extraordinary state of affairs, isn't it? But Tony, in the past, I know that you made the assertion that before entering frontline politics, Tony Blair was NMI5 asset who was spying on the campaign for nuclear disarmament. I mean, do you still stand by that?
Oh, definitely. I mean, this all came out in conversations with the former MI5 officer, Annie Machon. She actually spoke to the editor of the Sunday Times, and they knew, Blair knew, that people from MI5 were out speaking in her and her former partner, David Shaler, And Blair was incredibly nervous because he knew that they may have seen his MI5 files. They keep these things very secret. And so he was really scared. So, yes, definitely, this is a massive interference in democratic politics. The secret services nowadays, who, of course, are a kind of form of permanent government. And they have got so arrogant that they just think that they can direct political affairs. And as you can see around the world, particularly in the West here, you see similar laws being passed in all sorts of countries and a mass increase in mass.
Yes, indeed.
So difficult for institutions to carry on is because all of the people at the top of those institutions, whether it be journalists, politicians or whatever, are all under surveillance constantly.
Yeah. Well, David, I mean, just going back to Bob Villain then, I mean, do you think he's likely to be charged?
No, I mean, we've seen a lot of these kinds of threats in the last year against anti-Zionists, and almost all of them have come to nothing. I mean, there was the alleged charges that were going to be thrown at NECAP, who were the ones whose live show at Glastonbury was removed, and Bob Villain replaced it, and of course that's what led to that whole story. So, no, I mean, Bob Villain is not going to be charged. NECAP have not been charged. Anti-Zionists are winning every week now cases in court. There was recently a case even in the US which has declared that anti-Zionist views are not anti-Semitic and should be protected. So we're winning this battle. And, of course, you know, they may have some victories now and again, but the tide is turning against their ability to impose whatever they want.
And, of course, you've been in the vanguard of that struggle in the UK, haven't you, to make anti-Zionist views, you know, a protected characteristic in employment law. But I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. So I'd like to thank our guest, Tony Gosling, and make a date to join us again on Palestine Declassified next week, when I'll be back alongside David Miller with more revelations and information that you won't find in the corporate media. But until then, this is Chris Williams saying bye for now.
Searching for the light, and you see no hope in sight. Be sure and have no doubt, He is always close to you. He's the one who knows you best. He knows what's in your heart. You'll find your peace at last if you just have faith in Him. You're always in my heart and mind. Your name is mentioned every day. You no matter what, my biggest wish is to see you one day. 'Cause I believe, I believe, I believe. Do you believe? Oh, do you believe? 'Cause I believe. And liberty, and never would he hurt anything. He was a mercy for mankind, a teacher till the end of time. A creature could be compared with him, so full of light and blessings. You're always in my heart and mind. Your name is mentioned every day. I'll follow you no matter what. God will to me one day. Surely they will fade away if you just believe.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're tuned into Iran Radio. Let's quickly navigate what's coming up next. We're excited to present these programs, so please stay with us. Time to delve into economic divide. If you are interested in economic or business issues, then this program is definitely for you. Top experts on the economy give expert analysis and commentary on the biggest business and economic stories of the day. Mind-provoking insights into the economic issues. Then it's time to listen to Spring of Truth. This program features English translations of selected powerful statements and speeches from the founding father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini. May Allah bless his soul. What's next up? We are featuring a collection of our finest radio productions. These are specially curated segments designed to entertain, educate, and inform you, dear listeners. So keep us company. Up next is Economic Divide.
Economic Divide.
The sovereignty of a nation versus the power of the U.S. military. That is the situation that Venezuela finds itself in. The country with the richest and vast amount of natural resources like oil, gas, gold, and lithium is being targeted by the U.S., a regime change operation that has many goals in mind by removing the democratically elected president. The U.S. excuse that it is targeting drug cartels in Venezuela is not believed by anyone. What the U.S. wants from Venezuela is the removal of Maduro from power and to ultimately flood the market with Venezuelan oil and gas in order to decrease income from some of its enemies. Hi, I'm Karash Purnamati. This is The Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, our first headline, the U.S. wants regime change in Venezuela, and it's doing that through first a massive military buildup, hoping Maduro will cede power on his own. This would be another U.S. regime change scenario in Latin America. It's common knowledge that the U.S. wants Venezuela's riches like oil and gas. But what the U.S. doesn't want the world to know is how this could potentially achieve multiple U.S. goals impacting its adversaries. U.S. sanctions on Venezuela. The U.S. has sanctioned Venezuela for much of this past decade, hoping that crippling its economy would instigate a popular uprising. But that has failed to materialize since Venezuelans have substantially overcome some of these illegal sanctions. We're going to be discussing those points and a whole lot more with Professor Peter Kuznick, director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University, and also Ramon Grossfogel, professor at the University of California at Berkeley, specializing in decolonial studies and political economy of the world system.
Thank you for having me on the show. The excuse that Trump and members of his administration are giving is that Venezuela is in part responsible for the drugs that are flowing into the United States, and that therefore Maduro is a narco-terrorist, and the United States in order to protect its own national security, is destroying the boats that are carrying the drugs. This is a lie. It's total fabrication. What Trump says we're going after, the U.S. going after, is the fentanyl. Venezuela is not involved in transiting, manufacturing, producing, shipping fentanyl. The U.S. military told members of Congress that the drugs that are on some of these boats are cocaine, not fentanyl. Fentanyl is produced mostly in Mexico. So, number one, that's a lie. Number two, you don't send a vast armada and all these troops, 15,000 troops, to Venezuela, off the coast of Venezuela, to interdict drug boats. So the U.S. wants to invade Venezuela, partly because Venezuela has vast oil reserves. Some say the biggest oil reserves in the world. So that's what Trump is after. And if the U.S. is able to overthrow Maduro and take control of those oil reserves, that would have great impact not only on the world economy, but on global geopolitics.
Venezuela has suffered extreme hardship under illegal U.S. sanctions. An economic embargo has blocked Venezuela from accessing the U.S.-dominated international financial system and prevented Venezuela from exporting its oil and fixing or updating its oil infrastructure, causing government revenue to shrink by a staggering 99%, according to the top U.N. expert on sanctions, the special rapporteur Elena Duhani. However, Venezuela's economy today is in a much better state than it was previously during the previous U.S.-led attempt coup back in 2019 to 2020, which caused hyperinflation. The inflation rate has fallen a lot. Real wages have risen. Food and everyday necessities are affordable right now. The economy has dollarized a lot, however, which erodes the monetary sovereignty of the Venezuelan government.
Has a number of things in mind. Number one, it wants to seize Venezuela's oil. And that would then flood the market with oil, which would lower the price of oil and therefore have a devastating impact, the U.S. figures, on Russia's economy, on Iran's economy. But also, this is the U.S. way to overthrow the government in Cuba. Cuba is dependent on inexpensive oil from Venezuela. The Cuban economy would be, which is shaky already, would be sunk by cutting off that oil from Venezuela. The U.S. biggest prize in Latin America is, and it's not exactly Latin America, but South America, would be Brazil.
Welcome back. This is the social section of the program. The first item that we are covering for you is, can you imagine what would happen to oil exports if the U.S. really achieved a regime change in Venezuela? No wonder that Russia is so nervous about what's happening there. As the U.S. renews its threats against Venezuela, authorizes a CIA operation, and mobilizes regime change rhetoric,
the country is still being denied access to its own gold reserves, $1.8 billion frozen in the Bank of England. It's not about democracy. It's about control of Venezuela's old gold and lithium and punishing nations that resist the empire. The Cartel of the Suns was literally created by the CIA, also known as the Cocaine Import Agency. Max Blumenthal methodically exposes the WMD-level lies justifying U.S. attacks on Venezuela and explain the devastating consequences of a regime change war.
The big lie of this war is the Cartel of the Suns. As Ryan said, the Cartel of the Suns was literally created by the CIA, also known as the Cocaine Import Agency, to ship 22 tons of drugs into the United States in the early 90s through its main point of contact in the pre-Chavez Venezuelan National Guard, General Ramon Guillen.
Former U.S. Ambassador James Story. Maduro is sitting on top of the world's largest oil reserves, minerals that will fuel the 21st century economy, and he's in bed with our strategic competitors. It isn't about narco-trafficking, it certainly is not about democracy. It's about Monroe doctoring imperial domination to steal Venezuela's resources for U.S. corporations.
Thank you for inviting me to the program. The U.S. is in a big crisis. I would say that the U.S. empire is in a terminal crisis. They have lost the commercial wars with China in Africa and Asia. The last remaining space that they have at hand to keep their status as empire is Latin America. But however, in Latin America, there's still a strong presence of China in the markets and of sovereign countries that are challenging U.S. empire in the region. Venezuela is one of the richest countries in the world. It has the largest oil fields in the world. It has one of the countries with the large resources in gas. It's one of the countries with the largest resources in gold mines, in water, in minerals that are important for artificial intelligence, computers, and military industry. So it's a very wealthy country in terms of resources. And so what the U.S. is trying to do is to recover those resources as a way to recover its, come out of its own crisis. Remember, USA has a debt that is in the trillions. It's around $30 trillion with the letter T. And they need to, in a sense, do something dramatic in order to recover those resources from a rich country such as Venezuela, because the Bolivarian government has, kept sovereignty over its economy and over its natural resources.